The Mars Mortis Society invited me for the same reason they invited you, because Abraham Thorne is my father. Her mouth opened, but she couldn't find words. Having endured one shock after another tonight, she could only listen wide-eyed as Maximilian said, "I'm your brother, Alexandra."
Hello, and welcome back for the second time this episode to the Remedial Magic Podcast. My name's Brady, and as always, I'm joined by my brother Baylor and our good friend Delbert. How's it going, guys?
Good, and slowly learning that we should not mix up the intros.
Yeah, perhaps not, considering we had to restart recording this one, but that's beside the point. Baylor, how are you?
You know, I've been better. I blundered my one shot at being the lead host. So, oops.
Real shame.
You blundered your one shot at being the real host. I just dropped my phone and it hit the table real hard. All kinds of weird stuff's going on, but we're back. And Baylor, I wanted to say that you did a nice job. Our season premiere episode just came out, and you did a nice job dealing with the fact that the recording studio that, at least on our end of things, it doesn't sound great, and it, of course, doesn't sound like the same quality that we've been having, but it still sounds pretty good. Like, I've got some other podcasts I listen to that sound worse.
I was a little skeptical when I was editing it, just because of the difference. But actually, interestingly enough, I walked out Sunday morning and Dad was listening to it on his iPad, and it actually sounded pretty similar, like your guys' voices and my voice. So I was pleased.
It sounds decent. There's a little bit of echo that doesn't exist when we're in the normal recording studio, but it's good enough to get us by until the studio opens back up, I think.
Yeah, no, I definitely agree.
All right, good. So with those pleasantries out of the way, I wanted to remind everybody that we have social media. You can find the links to that in our link tree, Instagram, Twitter, our email address. Some interesting stuff about Baylor's grades from his predictions, as well as who we've casted so far during this book, is in there as well. But what I have to say, guys, is we're taking on what I think is a monumental task, trying to do chapters 9 through 12 in one episode.
This is a lot, and it's really cool stuff on top of that.
It's also your fault.
It is my fault. I'll take credit for that.
You committed us to this live on air during the last episode.
It's by far the most information, I think, that I've received in this entire series. And the most twists.
Nice. I don't remember saying it live, but sure.
It's insane. There's so much going on in this episode. So I think, even though I'm sure everybody loves to hear us expound upon our general thoughts about politics and the state of world affairs and Harry Potter, we should just dive right in. So, Baylor, would you summarize these chapters for us?
I will do my best. So, like Brady said, we begin with chapter 9, which is titled Halloween. First of all, the biggest drop of all, Darla attempts to kill Alex by casting Avada Kedavra. Does not work because, obviously, she's a young witch. Then, later, Alex goes through the Mors Mortis initiation, which actually wasn't as scary as I thought, but we'll get more into that. And then we see another big callback to the series, and especially thinking about the fourth book, a mysterious individual in the woods casts Mors Mortis and brings the dark mark of Voldemort into the skies of Charmbridge. We then move to chapter 10. There's an emergency drill because of the dark mark, which brings all of the students out very late at night. all of the teachers cast the Revealem Incantatum spell, I think is what it's called, to see their last spells that were cast to find the students that cast the Dark Mark. Dean Grimm then holds a school-wide assembly the next day just to give the entire student body a history of Voldemort and the Dark Mark and why it's not a good thing. And then finally, in a surprising twist, Alex quits the Morsmorna Society. So two chapters, two exciting twists. Then we're heading into chapter 11. Alex runs into M in the basement after she quits the Morsmorna Society. And then she kind of talks to her in actually a friendly way. Alex admits her fault to all of her friends later in the book. I believe that's the next day at lunch. During that same lunch, Tomo warns Alex to watch out for her and Anna's familiars, and they think Tomo is going to do something to them. And then Alex and Anna decide to go to the Morsmortis meeting because someone has taken honey from Angelique, because Alex and Anna had put protections up to protect their own familiars. So once again, Alex is back in a Morsmortis Society meeting. Then finally, chapter 12, titled Crucio. Alex breaks into the Morsmortis Society meeting. John Manuleto is casts Crucio on Alex three times and tortures her. And then Max intervenes, and Max and Alex have a deep, deep, deep conversation and reveal maybe the most exciting plot twist of the entire arc to be talked about here in a bit. But that's the arc. Hopefully I did better this time than the first summary I gave.
I think you did pretty good.
Yeah.
There is just so much going on in these four chapters. It is insane.
It is a lot. A lot of stuff, a lot of directions, a lot of twists, a lot of dark magic.
A lot of dark magic.
A lot of dark magic.
I gotta be honest, as well as all that stuff, the cliffhanger at the end of this one is far superior to any cliffhanger we've gotten so far.
Yep.
Way better than anything that happened in book one, I think.
Obviously, you guys know what's happening, what's going to happen next, but this was by far the hardest time that I've ever had but not continuing to read. Like, you know, it was just right there. Just one little scroll wheel touch and I could read the next chapter, you know? So, like, it's very, I'm very excited.
At least you don't have to wait, like, 4 weeks to read the next chapter or anything.
True, true. I'm definitely reading it tonight. And then we're definitely recording in a week.
Something like that. What's interesting about the way this arc begins is that it literally basically begins with Darla trying to kill Alex, which is crazy. It is insane. I think when you read it for the first time, it says that and you go, what the hell just happened?
So the first time I read this, it was the middle of COVID. I was sitting in my car, just in a parking lot, waiting between DoorDash orders. And I like read it, and then I just put my phone down and said, what? And just like sat there freaking out, almost like a little kid reading Harry Potter for the first time. For probably, I don't know, 90 seconds before I picked it back up and was like, how does she get out of this one? Because I thought she might have just been dead right then.
Yeah, how do you feel when you read that, Baylor, when it says, because for a little bit of background, they both sign up for a dueling competition, Alex and Darla, and they get paired up together. And so far in this competition, everybody has been casting exclusively Stupefy. And then Alex does the same thing, and Darla returns with Avada Kedavra. So you're sitting there reading this, Baylor. Were you expecting this wild twist?
Absolutely not. I've already told you guys this while we were playing D&D yesterday, but last week when I said, oh, I hope Darla and Alex's friendship grows even more, I'm excited for that. And then you guys were like, oh yeah, we muted our mics and we're laughing because we knew what was coming. I was at this moment, several things went through my head and I was like, I'm glad I didn't predict that because that would have been a 0 out of 10, first of all. Second of all, it honestly made me think of Sisters of House Black because we saw Bellatrix in that series, in that movie, excuse me, also struggle to cast Avada Kedavra on that flower. And then I thought about that, and then I was like, well, let's read on. I mean, obviously Alex isn't going to die because this is a 5-book series or whatever. But no, it definitely caught me off guard. So well done, Inverarity.
Absolutely insane that this happens. And why do we think that Darla is trying to kill Alex here? This seemingly makes no sense. It feels like a curveball.
There's a lot of questions about Darla. I thought, you know, we knew that she was from an influential family coming into this book. So her invitation to the Mors Mortis Society, you know, I guess could be explained that way. Like they want a famous kid there, you know. I think you've said that, Delbert, I think last episode. But like maybe there's something more sinister there or more something more sinister with her family.
I actually,
you know, coming into this.
I'm getting a little bit ahead. I'm going a chapter or two ahead here on our discussion. But I put some thought into what we had said last week about why are they invited to the Mors Mortis Society. And then we see them casting Mors Mortis and conjuring a dark mark above the school. Is everyone except for Alex, who obviously has the Abraham Thorn tie, pureblood? Is that what got them their invitations? Because Anna has a Muggle mother, so she's not there. David Washington's a Muggle-born, so he's not there. Is it a pureblood thing?
It's an interesting question. It's also a question we can't answer because we don't even know who all is in the Mors Mortis Society. I just think that it feels like this comes so far out of left field, but Baylor Delbert and I were just discussing something very interesting, how in one of the meetings, Darla has a vision that really scares her, like most of the people did. And we're wondering if maybe these two incidents can be related. Because, frankly, from my point of view, there's been no indication that Darla would want to kill Alex at all. It's just been, like, general snotty disdain the whole time instead. So, like, what flipped the switch? You know what I mean?
Yeah, exactly. I've been trying to think about that ever since I read this arc a couple days ago. And there's just nothing that I can think of that we know at this time, at least unless it's very obscure, that is telling me, oh yeah, Darla's an evil witch, you know? So I'm now not excited for their friendship. I'm excited for finding out why Darla is the Voldemort of Charmbridge.
Yeah. Yeah,
I mean, hell of a prediction.
It's a curious question, for sure, and it really sets the tone for this arc because this arc is all about dark magic. In fact, when last week when Delbert said that he would name this next set of chapters the Darker Arts, that definitely comes to play right away with Darla casting Avada Kedavra, and then even more as we get further into this section of chapters, because we also see later on, jumping ahead a little bit, the effective use of another one of the unforgivable curses in Crucio, because Alex makes the leaders of the Mors Mortis Society angry. So Charmbridge is not Hogwarts.
No.
Hogwarts, for the most part, is like a happy, cheery, wonderful fantasy type of place. Charmbridge is, frankly, kind of scary. It would not be a fun place to be a student if you're mixed up with the wrong people.
Once again, we see a very direct departure from the original series, which we've talked about several times. But even in this first book, the first book of Alex Quick, we saw like a gruesome death, like blood and whatever else. But even in the first book, unless, correct me if I'm wrong, we didn't even hear about unforgivable curses. And so to throw in both Avada Kedavra and Crucio in the first half of the second book is unheard of. Like I think it's unprecedented. Inverarity is trying to show us at this point.
I agree. I mean, even in the original series where these things were all, you know, created, they weren't mentioned at all until the fourth book.
Yep.
So it's definitely a much darker turn, much earlier than we're used to.
It's very intense. There's something much more intense about the fact that this is a 12-year-old trying to murder another 12-year-old than if this had been an adult trying to do the same thing. Like, this surprised me and kind of, like, if affected me more than when Ben Journey tried to shoot Alex. At least we knew he was an evil adult. Here, Darla's doing this seemingly out of nowhere. So the whole thing was just wild. In fact, normally we go through somewhat in order, but I just want to talk about all the dark stuff that happens right off the top, right? Because Alex has her life attempted on by Avada Kedavra. She goes to the Mors Mortis initiation, and after that's over with, somebody casts Voldemort's mark, the Dark Mark, into the sky, which is really interesting because this is quite a ways away from Voldemort and in a different country as well. And even during the initiation, we see Alex almost try to cast Avada Kedavra as well, right? So all that stuff happens, and that's only chapter 9, right? There's an entire chapter about Crucio. There's a chapter in this arc about sacrificing somebody's familiar to put a curse upon them. It's a lot.
The other thing, too, that I want to bring up is you kind of skipped over the initiation because, you know, it's a Boggart. We've dealt with those in Harry Potter. When the Boggart's introduced in Harry Potter, at least in the movie for sure, there's a large spider for Ron. There's a snake. There's even a clown, I believe, for one of the Patil twins. This one is much more, I believe we see it in the original series, Molly Weasley clearing out a Boggart, and there's just her dead kids. And we're seeing that same thing here with Bonnie and Brian and Archie and Claudia. And we're also seeing that one of the other characters, one of the other named characters, sees our heroine, or our main character, as their Boggart.
Yeah.
It's dark. It's very dark.
Yeah, so you're talking about the initiation right now. Right?
Yeah.
The process of the initiation is the kids show up, they sneak out first into the woods, and they show up in this clearing, and then one by one they enter this tree trunk, and when they go in there, they're faced with a Boggart, but it's not a domesticated Boggart, which is interesting. Apparently, at least Inverardi's establishing that the Boggarts we see in the main series are domesticated. At least the one they encounter in their third year at Hogwarts.
Right.
Right? This is a wild Boggart, and apparently wild Boggarts, they go off. They don't hold back. In fact, when Alex goes to face this Boggart, she sees dead Bonnie, dead Brian, dead Archie, dead Claudia, and they're all screaming at her with, like, empty eye sockets, telling her that it's her fault they're dead and that she's a dark witch and all this crazy stuff. It's intense. Like, yeah. I've said that a lot already this episode, but man, the imagery is wild.
Yeah. I mean, if anyone ever reads this series and they get through this section of chapters and they're not going to read anymore, like, I don't know how you could read all this and not just be enticed enough to read the entire series.
Yeah.
It's so good.
I agree. I agree 100%. Now, I did think it was pretty funny how in the end of this chapter, when they're talking about the Dark Mark being cast, all of them aren't really that scared of it. They're more like, why is that there? Doesn't that belong to that other guy in Britain? They don't even really know his name, you know? So I think that's pretty funny because this is our strictest callback to the original series that we've gotten so far. And still the characters are basically just blowing it off like it doesn't matter.
My biggest thing with this is, interestingly, it's almost like a swastika nowadays, right? Like, a lot of us younger generation, we understand the significance of it, but we don't feel those emotions, the fear, you know, the worry, whatever, that like seeing a swastika for an elderly person might feel. Someone that was alive when World War II happened. And so I can only imagine that this, obviously Voldemort's Dark Mark is probably the same way. Like, we have kids here who are like, yeah, this is the dark thing. This is the Dark Lord's sign. But they're like, that's just it, you know. But for these older generations who probably not only maybe experienced some of Voldemort's reign, but also are dealing with the copycats that have that Dean Graham was talking about in America. You know, it's probably pretty terrifying to see that sign again, especially when, once again, from the original series, if that sign is showing, typically someone died.
Yeah, and I mean, you're exactly right, because even in Goblet of Fire, right? Harry, Ron, and Hermione are standing around when it's cast, and I think Hermione knows what it is, but they don't really react to it, but all the adults are just done. They're like there to kill and apprehend or send to Azkaban anyone in the area.
Yeah, they know. It's like similar to, obviously, I have some ties to Norway. Baylor, you and I both do, but our brother who lives in Norway has been told us this story about how, like, a little while after the Nazi occupation of Norway, they went back to film a movie there, and they put the Nazi flag back up where it had flown during the occupation as part of this movie, and they had like a record number of calls to emergency services and stuff trying to figure out what was going on, because all the people who had lived through it were panicking because they didn't realize what was going on. And so this is very similar to that. And so even the American adults definitely recognize the gravity of the symbol. I really think it's interesting that this is like kind of a children's prank in America, but if this had happened at Hogwarts, it would have been pandemonium, I'm guessing. It would have been insanity. So, and that gets addressed, right? Because after that happens, we move into the next chapter, and Dean Grimm holds a school-wide assembly to address the events of Halloween night, and she pretty much says immediately what you guys just said, talking about how Voldemort, who he was, the things that he did, why he's a bad person. And she says, basically, point blank, two kids were found responsible for causing this last night. They've been expelled. If any of you do anything with dark magic at all, you'll be expelled too. And so it's a fitting thing for her to say in the middle of all this intrigue about whether or not Alex is participating in the dark arts. What did you guys think of the entire scene, the description of the scene where Alex has to go wake Angelique up?
Pretty funny.
Pretty funny. Yeah. I agree.
I also, I don't know if I misunderstood the scene or not, but it sounds like quite a few kids were either underdressed or naked. Yeah. Thrown out into the hallway. Which, okay, that I'm all sure, fine. But were they put into a co-ed group before they were given the robes? Because that's what it sounded like to me, and that part's a little bit questionable if that's how that actually was intended. Because, like, when David gets his robe, Angelique's there. And he's just in his underwear.
Yeah, no, it was definitely a little strange because it seemed like David was in his underwear or whatever, and all the girls were giggling, like they obviously saw something before the robe was handed out. And so it's very strange situation for a school to put students in without, you know, their without their choice, you know what I mean? Like, I think that's unheard of nowadays.
I think while the whole scene is relatively funny, it's also pretty uncomfortable when you're like reading descriptions of these young children being naked or whatever. And it's like you said, Delbert, when I was reading this, I'm going, so they're like this in front of the entire student body now?
Yeah, because, like, that's what I was getting at. Like, maybe I'm misreading it, and they're just giggling at the people that have the robes on because they know they're naked. Like, maybe it's that kind of childish giggle. But the way it was written, I almost thought that, I'm pretty sure the girls and the boys are on, like, different floors or different hallways, but it almost sounded like they brought them together and then dispersed the robes.
The conversation about them getting robes was definitely, everybody was lumped together during that conversation,
right?
But you're right that it's not clear whether that happened before or after they were brought together.
It was just a little weird reading it.
Either way, I think it is hilarious that Angelique has to cast a silencing charm on her bed so she can sleep because the stupid ferret or whatever it is
Jarvie.
That Jarvie won't shut up.
Yeah, and to be fair, Alex is correct, right? Cast the silencing charm on the cage, maybe?
Yeah.
Instead of yourself?
Yeah.
Kill the Jarvie, maybe.
Alright, Sean.
But you think that was a bit of an oversight by her, to cast it on herself instead of the Jarvie.
It's an oversight, I think, if she's an adult. But she's like a kid, so she thinks, what can I do? I know, I'll make it so I can't hear anything.
Maybe Darla starts, oh, yeah, too. Yeah. So she's just used
Yeah, true.
I was just going to say that.
It's just, that scene is, it's well written.
The scene with waking her up is for really, sure, really funny. The stinging or whatever Jinx, or snapping Jinx on.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Later on, actually, we should talk about that. Alex wakes Angelique up by casting a stinging Jinx.
Snapping Jinx.
A snapping Jinx on her behind. And this actually, I think, saves Alex from getting in more trouble than she gets in. Because after all the kids are brought together, they do the Priori Incantato charm on all their wands to see who casts the Mors Mordae. But Alex had just tried to cast Avada Kedavra.
She didn't finish it, though. I don't know if it would show or not.
But it's like, when I was reading that, even today, I was like nervous for her, yeah, until I realized that there was a little bit of Deus Machina put in by her casting that snapping Jinx.
Right.
You know, after the assembly, Alex's friends approach her with a pretty hardline approach. They basically say, either tell us honestly what you're doing, or that's it. And she doesn't tell them honestly what she's doing, and they all give her the cold shoulder. She, like, all of a sudden is friendsless for a little bit. Do you think this was appropriate for them to do? An overreaction? An underreaction, perhaps?
I honestly thought it was the perfect reaction, because the entire first book and up until this point, they basically had empty threats. And then, you know, from this point when she couldn't answer them truthfully and, you know, couldn't say that she wasn't meddling in dark arts, like, I mean, good Lord, Constance and Forbearance couldn't even sit next to her. And then David was giving her the cold shoulder. And then even Anna was like, you know, I don't really trust you at this time, you know, that kind of thing. And so it really hit home finally, I think, that her friends won't put up with whatever she's going to do.
I think it's also important, like, I know we've already said multiple times how insane these chapters are, but let's look through the eyes of Constance and Forbearance and David. They just saw one of the girls that they've been pretty much friends with tried to kill one of their closest friends after knowing that there's a dark magic society going on. They see something happen up in the sky that's so bad that Dean Grimm, who is notoriously not, like, active in teaching the students, it seems, like, she's kind of, you don't want to see Dean Grimm, blah, 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 blah. She's hosting an assembly talking about how horrible it is and how people are getting expelled, and then threatening an expulsion to anybody that partakes in or doesn't tell about other people partaking. So, I mean, at this point, it's absolutely the right decision.
I agree. And Dean Grimm, the way she presents that as well, I think she knows. I think she's much more aware than the leaders of the Mors Mortis Society would like to think that she is.
That's probably good for the sake of the school, to be honest, but what they're dealing with.
Yeah, I agree. And Baylor, I wanted to touch on a point you made about how you said that it's like the time for Alex to finally realize what she's doing, because she does actually end up realizing that in a future chapter, and she goes back to her friends and she tells them, like, what she's been doing, basically. Like, she says, I haven't been honest with you. This is what you need to know about what I've been doing. And I think it makes her life actually quite a bit better to not be hiding so much of this all the time.
I also think, hopefully going forward, this shows her that she can be more truthful with them than she thought she could. Because as soon as she told the truth, you know, they were back to being friends like she wanted. So hopefully this will maybe not, will help her not to be as secretive going forward.
Baylor, I agree. But I also have my doubts, since I'm pretty sure I've heard you say those exact words twice during book one.
most definitely, yeah.
This time it feels more weighty, though, you know? Like, the apology feels like it really came from a place that Alex intended it to come from, rather than her just saying it to get, like, the Ozarkers off her back or whatever.
Right.
Now, how do you guys feel about the fact that Darla has tried to kill Alex with Avada Kedavra, and not even a day later is back in school, returned from expulsion?
Immediately, she's a Malfoy, in my mind. Like, that was my thought when this happened.
I literally was just going to say that. Yep.
Powerful, connected parents, probably with a lot of money, that basically bought her way back in.
I mean, that is exactly what happened, but I'm disgusted, yeah. Frankly.
Seems like Dean Grimm is, too, to be fair.
I agree. I think it's not Dean Grimm's fault or choice whatsoever. She seems pretty upset at the idea that Darla bought her way back in there. And on top of that, if Darla had left the series right now because she tried to kill Alex, that would have been satisfying, I think.
True.
Like, this was a good exit for her if this was going to happen.
True.
It would have sucked not knowing why, but we don't know why anyways.
Yeah.
So, get the would-be murderer the heck out of here.
Yeah. Also, one thing I want to point out in this conversation is Darla, of course, apologizes to Alex. Alex seems to accept the apology kind of genuinely. But she then talks to Dean Grimm alone, where we find out that, you know, it wasn't really her choice to bring Darla back. But also, she goes off on a rant about how if she was the one who had done this, she wouldn't be unexpelled because she doesn't have the parental connections and her father can't say anything to get her back. But Dean Grimm comes in with a nice fire line that says, basically, if you were the one who had tried to cast that, I think we'd have a dead student.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Very much an acknowledgement of Alex's power compared to her classmates once again, right?
It was like a nice little side compliment.
Dean Grimm really, in my opinion, is redeeming herself a little bit because she's also very real with Alex and she says, you're probably right and it's not fair, but life's not fair.
Yeah.
Like, just, you don't have the ability to get ahead in that way and you just have to deal with it.
I'll also say that while Alex is still complaining to her about this, she is way more mature in these conversations than she was in book one.
Oh, significantly.
Yeah, and I think it's even a little, nod to that when Dean Grimm says, how's J-Rock? And then says, oh, well, it's been good for you, or something like
that. Yeah.
I think a lot of it is tied back to that power comment, because we see in the first book, you know, we kind of see the unfair treatment towards Alex from Dean Grimm, which, whatever. But in my opinion, if I'm Alex, I would much rather be expelled than be tortured, you know, and be subject to becoming a rat or whatever, you know. But I also think that Dean Grimm is kind of in a tough spot where we're starting to see that she's being told from the outside what to do, and she doesn't really have any control over it, I think. And this is true with Alex. Like, she's told, you got to keep Alex there because we don't know what'll happen if she leaves and Abraham finds her or whatever, you know. So I think we're finally starting to see why Dean Grimm was doing what at least maybe for me, I don't know. We probably never get the answer. But kind of why she was doing what she was doing in the first book.
Yeah, I would argue that there's got to be outside influence because, and Dean Grimm basically just says it, but she would never allow a student who tried to kill another student to come back to school, I think. I believe her when she says stuff like that. So,
well, you think about, too, like Diana Grimm, she says, if I were my sister, I would do it differently. And I know I said siblings have typically differing ideas about how to control stuff or how to deal with issues, but I'm kind of the opinion at this point that Dean Grimm probably wanted to tell Alex the truth, and then she wasn't able to because of Huckstein or Raspire or somebody other, a higher power somewhere else.
There's potential for that, for sure. And interestingly enough, you know, Dean Grimm has Darla apologize to Alex. Alex and Dean Grimm have this long conversation. And really, the outcome, at least in the short term, is that nothing really changes because Alex goes to the next Mors Mortis Society meeting basically without hesitating because she's so morbidly curious about what she's going to learn there. And when she gets there, what she learns is that she doesn't want to be part of it anymore.
Yeah, I was a little worried right here because that's kind of what Alex does. She's like, oh yeah, I'll quit. And then she like her curiosity gets the better of her. And so I was very pleased that she still quit.
Yeah, I mean, good on her. The other thing, too, is we kind of skipped over it. You said nothing happens once Darla comes back, which is true for Alex. Like, nothing really changes with her. But I think, especially going into the next chapter, it's important to note as well that when Darla comes back, she doesn't have friends. Angelique's not sitting next to her at lunch. She's off hanging out with two of the older guys in the Mors Mortis Society for lunch.
Right. And
no one's talking to her.
It's pretty important to note that, I think, because she's clearly unstable in some way.
And this is pushing her even further.
And this is making it worse, right? Yeah. And so who knows what the consequences of that will be.
We do, since we read the next chapter.
Yeah, but I want to address what you're saying, Baylor, with being surprised, but happily surprised, that Alex quits the Mors Mortis Society. And the reason she quits is because when she gets there, the next lesson is to learn how to cast Crucio. And not only are they casting Crucio, they're doing it on innocent animals. And Alex does not stand for that shit. She's not okay with using animals to torture them to learn a new spell or whatever else. But I think it's really interesting because when you're first reading this, you don't know what Alex is going to do. She's so curious that there's a good chance when you're first reading this that she's going to go through with it and cast Crucio.
Yeah. And
that is kind of scary as with her as the main character, because you never know what the tipping point's going to be, but doing something like that, that's a tipping point for a lot of people.
Yeah, I think Alex is inherently good. Like I've said that before, and I still believe that. But the going off what you're saying, I think a big issue would be Alex would find a way to use Crucio to her advantage, even though it is a dark spell. And so, yeah, I think it's a very dangerous game to play. And I definitely, that's why I was surprised, because I thought, oh, she's going to just hop right in here.
I mean, you don't even have to look very far for knowing that. I mean, she had heard of Avada Kedavra once, and she tried to cast it, you know, a couple hours later.
Yeah, it's interesting. I don't know. We could talk about this Darla Avada Kedavra thing all day long.
Yeah.
But she's heard of it once, and she goes and tries to cast it.
Yeah.
There's no way that it's just a random thing that just came into her mind in that moment, you know? Like, even a 10-year-old understands the implications of pointing a gun at somebody and pulling the trigger. Right? You would think.
Yeah.
I don't know. Moving on, in the interest of time, Alex quits the Mors Mortis Society and steals the snake that they were going to cast Crucio on. And as she leaves, going into Chapter 11, she gets kind of lost in the basement. Things aren't where they were, which we know is typical of magical schools. And she runs into an old character, a character from book one, Im, the house elf. And Im, I don't know that she's acting the same way now that she was in book one, because she doesn't immediately petrify Alex and go get a teacher to deal with her. Instead, they have a conversation, and Im says some frankly scary stuff, I think.
Yeah. It's just more on more on more on these chapters, because Em looks at the snake. Is Em a he or a she?
I believe this is a female house elf.
Okay, so Em, yeah, we're going with she. Yeah. She sees the snake, says, "What are you doing with the snake?" And when Alex says she found it down here, she's like, "Oh, What? Did it come from the lands below?
Yeah, and it's like, whoa. As soon as she says that, I'm like, what the hell is she talking about?
I'm like, oh, so we've been in the lands below half this book then.
Yeah, it's like confirmation that the lands below is a place, right?
Right.
Gives us a little bit more insight into the book title as well. And for her credit, to Em's credit, she should be getting Alex in trouble here, and she doesn't. She just helps her get back to her dorm.
Yeah.
Were you expecting this at all? Either one of you?
I was a little nervous initially just because of how quick Em was to, summon Ben Journey in the first book to try, because students aren't allowed in the basement. But I honestly kind of think both Alex's, her behavior towards elves, one, and also two, the fact that Em, the last time she left Alex to go fetch a teacher, she came back and thought that she was dead or seriously hurt. I think both of those things are working in Alex's favor here, and that's why Em is more of a friend rather than a authority at this point.
I also think that there's a chance, and maybe the Imperius curse, but probably more just, hey, watch out for this girl, that Ben Journey had been telling the house elves or whoever might be around, hey, if she's here, let me know, or something along those lines.
That's interesting. When you said Imperius curse, it made me think that maybe somebody from the Mors Mortis Society has done that to Em already and has told her not to get anybody from the society in trouble.
Interesting.
That's an interesting thought. I definitely didn't think about that.
It's interesting because we have the opposite idea. Like, I think maybe they were Imperius first book, and you're thinking maybe they're Imperius now?
Yeah, maybe.
Yeah.
Who knows? But Em helps Alex leave the basement after getting her a nice cage to keep the snake in. And then the next thing we know, Alex is the scene where Alex is admitting her faults to her friends. And we've already talked about that, but another thing to point out here is that an understory behind all of this Mors Mortis stuff is that Max has been hoping Alex would quit at some point, and now that she has quit, he's being nicer to her at the J-Rock meetings and the J-Rock exercises, which I appreciate, to be honest.
At least he followed through.
He did, and I get tired of people just yelling the whole book. It gets annoying, in my opinion, definitely. So I'm glad that he's quit doing that. But more importantly, as the next day goes on, Tomo comes and warns Alex, though Alex thinks it's a threat, that she needs to watch out for her familiars. And so Alex takes this as a threat, but pretty quickly Honey goes missing.
Yeah, I mean, Alex and Anna, they rush back, they check on their familiars. I'm not sure, Baylor said something about protecting them, I must have missed it. But you're right, then Honey, Angelique's familiar, goes missing instead.
Interestingly enough, I was a little surprised. Well, yeah, I think I'm safe to say I was a little surprised. I've been surprised several times in these chapters. But I was definitely surprised that Alex and Anna reacted so quickly to this threat. I don't know how you guys feel about it, I guess. But I was surprised.
It's interesting because I think the only reason they react so fast is because of the conflict that they've already had with Tomo. And Alex reacts quickly because she knows Tomo's in the Mors Mortis Society. And she knows that they're doing some pretty messed up stuff down there. And so I think she's pretty legitimately worried about Charlie when she gets this warning, especially since she interprets it as a threat, like Tomo's saying, I'm coming for you, even though that's not necessarily what's going on. Now I have a question.
Yep.
We find out later on that the reason Honey is missing is because our good friend Darla has stolen Honey.
Mm-hmm.
Did you suspect Darla at any point here in this section of the reading, because I don't want to say that I did the first time, but I did make note that she was being like way too reassuringly nice to Angelique during this time.
To me, I thought that Tomo's warning was for Alex and Anna. I thought it was a warning. And then so she obviously failed because they locked up their room, they protected their familiars, whatever. But I think because Darla was also in the Mors Morta Society, she was instructed to steal a familiar for herself. And so I was thinking, oh, Darla went the easy route and stole honey.
So you thought it was Darla right away?
I did, yeah. Yep.
I'll be honest, as soon as Darla was sitting away from her friends with the older Mors Mortis kids, I just wrote her off as going to be the villain.
Yeah.
So, I mean, she was on my radar all the time.
It's interesting. Darla seems to have be pegged by the Mors Mortis Society as well as the villain, I think, because they keep targeting her with their objectives. Like, they give her the Snake Stone. They tell her she needs to go steal somebody's familiar, right? Tomo wasn't instructed to take anybody's familiar, as far as I know.
I mean, is that not the case? It's got to be all tied together, right? I mean, all of these events that she solely is given. I don't think Tomo. Well, we do find out that Tomo was giving Alex and Anna not a warning. Well, a warning, but it wasn't a threat like we initially thought.
Right.
And I know I just said warning, but I meant threat when I was saying that I thought of Darla. But regardless, it does appear that Darla is the one being targeted by these people, which, now that you bring that up, makes me wonder why she's being targeted, because honestly, through the first book, other than being rich and being kind of, I guess, my opinion of the popular girl, I guess, at Charmbridge, I don't think she's been very significant magically or otherwise in this book and the first book.
One thing's for certain is she has earned some serious clout with the Mors Morta Society, strictly for trying to cast Avada Kedavra at Alex. So much so that even though she was expelled, they accepted her as a full member without her going through initiation. And so there is something weird going on, because she's the one that they keep pointing out all the time. Now, Alex, of course, isn't going to just sit around and wait for something to happen to Honey, and Alex is pretty smart, so she figures, well, there's Honey's probably going to be at the next Mors Mortis Society meeting for some reason, and so she decides to stay up late and sneak back to the meeting, even though she's no longer welcome there, and Anna goes with her, because Anna's tired, sick and tired of Alex's crap once again, which happens about once a week, and they sneak out. Alex casts some interesting, like, the new spells we talked about last time to freeze the picture frames. Then they run into Tomo in the basement. And here I'm thinking, okay, we're going to have another fight between Anna and Tomo. And instead, what we find out is that Tomo joined the Mors Morta Society because she's absolutely terrified of Alex and Anna.
Well, there is a little bit of fighting. There's a little bit of racism in here. And also, just wanted to clarify as well, because this is where it happens, but Tomo does admit that she broke into their room and was supposed to steal the snake, or hurt the snake.
Oh, true, yeah.
So she was also instructed to do something involving familiars, so.
And she says that here.
Yes.
Right? And you're right to point out that there was a little bit of fighting, but compared to what we've seen, nothing too major, and in fact, compared to what we didn't see, but that gets described in this chapter from before, that Alex didn't even know about, nothing at all. Not only is there some mean things said, there is a very blatant racial slur said also in this chapter, or at least talked about in this chapter. And so I just wrote in the notes, we find out there's even more to the conflict between Anna and Tomo than the readers knew.
Well, the other thing, too, I want to point out here, it seems like Anna, like, we knew that she was involved in this early, but she may have been even more involved than we thought.
Right.
Like, she may have been somewhat more the instigator.
I was going to say, it makes her seem like the instigator.
Yeah, it seems like she's pretty racist against the Japanese.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's bizarre.
I certainly hope that we get more information as the book goes on, because this is definitely interesting to me, because Anna never acted like this in the first book.
Yeah, it's totally out of character compared to who she is in the first book. I completely agree. And I think it's extremely funny that Alex made Anna take Tomo back to her room.
You say funny, I say possible murder.
This is like Alex being a parent.
A little bit. Like,
you two aren't getting along? You're going to hold hands for the rest of the day. It cracks me up that that was her response.
Well, I think we also see that potentially Tomo could be a friend, you know. I think she's more, I don't know, maybe I'm speaking too much, but, you know, I could see a more positive relationship going forward between Tomo and Anna and Alex.
I completely agree. This established that they're going to be at least cordial from now on, I think.
Yeah. I will say, though, that my reading of characters has been horrible, because I thought Darla and Alex were going to be friends, so maybe Tomo will try to kill Alex next chapter.
Nice. I also think here, too, that Anna's surprised. I think Anna didn't look at herself at all as being wrong in this situation, and after this is all shown, and like she's only here to learn dark arts because she's scared of Anna and Alex, I think she kind of like calms down a second and says, oh, wait, what?
Yeah.
Because Alex already knew this. She knew that her bog art form was Alex. She knew that. But this is all new to Anna. She has no idea how terrified of the two of them, really, that Tomo is.
It's a good reminder for Anna that she's not innocent in the situation.
Yeah.
And it also gives Alex an excuse to get Anna the heck out of here, right? Because Alex doesn't want Anna to know what's going on at these meetings at all. Because I think it's probably what's happening at the meetings is worse than what Anna thinks is happening at the meetings even. And so her being able to send Tomo and Anna back away from this place accomplishes diplomacy and subverts Anna's expectations of what's going to happen as well. So it's played really well by Alex, actually.
Yeah, it's good. I know you said it might be worse, but all Anna's seen is a tribute to a guy who killed mudbloods and the killing curse. So, I mean, summoning, like, spectral ghosts and, I guess, torturing stuff is pretty bad, but it's like a different kind of bad.
It is a different kind of bad, but the whole thing is a thing. Anna doesn't have the character to handle the contents of a Mors Mortis meeting, I think. Yeah.
I mean, she's seen you know, the Avada Kedavra spell fail on Alex, which obviously was scary, but I think it's different when you see the animal or, spoiler alert, in this case, Alex, like that individual squirming on the ground in pain because of Crucio. You know what I mean? So I definitely think, I know, like, Alex wants to not have Anna there, but I honestly think it was a smart decision, but also a stupid decision, because Alex walks into this meeting by herself.
This group of people
that she's already, like, you know, annoyed the hell out of, because she didn't quit in the most elegant fashion. Let's be honest. Just walks in there and knows that they can cast this torture charm.
Yeah, as soon as chapter 12 starts, Alex barges into the meeting. First, she stupefies the guy who's supposed to be the guard, barges into the meeting, casts Expelliarmus on John Manuelito to get this knife that he's brandishing over top of a petrified honey out of his hand, and then proceeds to just announce her presence in the most Alex way possible, right? She barges in, and then she goes, oh, wait a second, this might actually be dangerous for me.
It shames me to do this, but I'm revoking her Slytherin card. I'm now all aboard the Gryffindor train.
Because of the just distinct lack of self-preservation. Running in
with no plan and then being like, oh, wait. That's literally just Harry Potter in a nutshell.
It is. Now, once she breaks in, it's pretty much established that Darla is the one who stole honey from Angelique. And they're getting ready to do some kind of sacrificial ritual magic to put a curse on Angelique through her familiar, which I'm telling you, this Mors Mortis thing is insanity. It is crazy what they're doing in these places, but that's not really the important part. The important part here, at least the first important thing, is that John Manuelito, he's not thrilled with Alex in this moment. He's not okay with what's going on. He's been interrupted. And I think cult leaders don't like it when they get interrupted, for the most part. And so he casts Expelliarmus on Alex and then proceeds to cast Crucio on her.
Multiple times.
Three times.
Yep. Yeah.
We already know. Yeah, it's well established. You can go insane if this happens to you too much. And he does it to her three times. A senior in high school. What's wrong with this guy?
Pretty messed up,
yeah,
man.
Yeah.
He does it for seemingly in a extended period of time as well, for all three times.
I did make note, Alex handled this very similarly to the way Harry handled it when he was crucioed as well. She like had this steely resolve to not cry out in pain or anything like that. And so I thought that was pretty cool.
Yeah.
Max intervenes, which is nice. He stops it, and he takes Alex and the Jarvie away from the meeting, right? He takes Alex and Honey out of the meeting, says he'll take care of Alex, and then the biggest twist in the history of Alex Quick to this point happens, I think, where he's kind of checking her for injuries. He's explaining that the contract she signed with the Mors Mortis Club probably can't actually kill her. And then he says, people treat me back at my school the way people treat you here, by the way. And she's kind of like, why is that? And he says, well, because we got the same daddy. And so, Baylor, I just want to get your reactions to reading that.
Well, I'm not going to lie. This just to show you how off guard I was when that statement came out. Obviously, he didn't say we have the same daddy, but I honestly thought that it was like going to be one of those things where, you know, just like a love scene where they were going to start making out. I'm not going to lie, because he was like being careful, like, you know, like he was being gentle, I guess would be a good way to say it. And I was like, oh boy, here we go. This is going to be some weird scene. And then he's like, yeah, by the way, my last name's Thorn too. And I was like, what?
Yeah, he tells her he's his brother, luckily. I thank the Lord they don't start making out.
Yeah. I was a little concerned. I was like starting to feel a little uneasy, but
well, not even the Sweet Home Alabama thing. More the fact that he's 18 and she's 12 or whatever.
I mean, it's equal parts bad. Yeah.
It's pretty unfortunate either way, but luckily they're both just the offspring of the most notorious dark wizard in the Confederation.
Right.
Luckily, that's all it is.
No romance anywhere.
No romance. But on a more serious note, after thinking about it, you know, the initial reaction, it's absolutely crazy. I mean, it makes a lot of sense because they kind of look the same. They have long black hair. That's kind of the only matching feature that we've always picked on. But I don't know. It kind of left me not speechless because I wasn't talking, but kind of, you know, left me that way in my brain. Like, I still haven't really picked it over, and I'm undecided what the effects will be going forward. And to be honest with you guys, I know, I'll be doing my prediction later, but it honestly took me like 3 days to think of my prediction. I would say. Kind of an idea of what I was going to base it off of and what I was going to ask you guys.
It's a huge subversion of expectations.
Well, you say that, but, and maybe I'm wrong here, but I thought maybe I'm just misremembering, but when we were recording the chapter where Darla runs up to, I believe, Martin in the store, and it describes this guy with dark hair looking at Alex. I swear that Baylor said, maybe a brother or something.
He did.
Okay.
He did, but I think it was, correct me if I'm wrong, Baylor, but it struck me as more of just an off-color comment than anything else.
Yeah, pretty much, because I think Delbert, you know, made a comment about how it's a book about people with long dark hair, and I was like, yeah, maybe it's another brother, you know, something like that. So I definitely wasn't thinking it. I wish I was, because that would have been the greatest prediction score of my life.
True. I do remember you saying it, and I just, like, wide-eyed was like, oh, how the hell? Because I did not see this coming my first time around at all.
I will say one final thought about it before we move on to the extra segments is that I just thought that he knew who her father was, and he was, like, a hard-ass follow the law type of guy, and so that he was just treating her poorly because of her association to her father.
Yeah, well, I've said for 2 weeks now that I thought maybe her father killed his family or something.
Yeah.
And he was there for vengeance.
I think it's very much, for me, I was thinking kind of along the same lines, like these people at BMI are very protective of the Confederation, and they saw Abraham Thorne and his escape as, like, you know, the end of the world, pretty much. And so just because his daughter exists and is able to be a normal student was, like, enough to piss this guy off and just make him into the jerk that he was.
Yeah. I mean, at any rate, this bombshell is where this section of chapters ends. They basically just agree, we've got a lot to talk about. Let's talk about it another day. And then it ends, and we have to talk about a different young man with long black hair. John Manuelito.
True. Our casting for this week.
Indeed.
Now, just for the sake of the casting, Brady, you and I conferred and determined that it would be okay to confirm that he's Native American descent.
Indeed. To get an accurate representation of this guy in our movie series.
Yes.
Baylor needed to know that he's a Native American.
Yes. Now, I'll go ahead and lead off the casting this week, and before I do so, I would love to say I'm ignorant of cultures like this. I do not know any specific, like, traits or anything that would be certain tribal people or anything. So I just went with, you know, someone from the Sioux tribe. I didn't, like, specify anything that would make sense for the area. But I went with, and I don't know his name because he has two different ones on Google, but Gerald Takala Black Elk Clifford. So part of that might be a stage name or a tribal name, I don't really know. But the picture of him that I found makes me really feel like it's a John Manuelito kind of look. And Brady, I can show you. Baylor, you can Google it, but...
Oh, I agree.
I think he could definitely play that kind of villain, aged down a little bit.
I'm there. He's in the show Yellowstone.
He is in Yellowstone, which I haven't seen, but I've heard it's really good.
It is good.
Speaking of Yellowstone, Flooded.
It is.
Rip.
It is.
So that's my casting. Yes,
Baylor. Delbert, when I was putting him in the spreadsheet, I obviously, you know, put in a link to their name, and his IMDb profile is Takala Black Elk. So maybe that's his full name.
That's what his Yellowstone wiki reads, but his just raw Google search just says Gerald Takala Clifford.
Oh, okay. Well,
whatever. Well, tell you what, Gerald Takala Clifford, if you listen, write in.
Write in.
Yeah. I'd love to have you.
You look like a guy named John Manuelito.
Yes. Baylor, since you were discussing my pick and correcting my names, you can go second.
All right. So, I mean, it didn't click in my head when I heard the initial description of John Manuelito, but then you guys told me that he was Native American and had long dark hair and was tall, and I instantly thought of, you know, the girl down the street's favorite actor. The sensation that brought the greatest war in acting history, for likeness, I guess, and that is Taylor Lautner, who played Jacob Black in Twilight.
He's the very first person I thought of when trying to think of who to cast.
Same, which is just me not knowing enough actors with that descendancy.
Yeah, me not knowing enough Native American male actors, and him specifically from the first Twilight movie where he has long hair, it fits the description just fine.
True. In the first one, yes.
Yeah.
In the other ones,
yeah.
No chance.
It would be interesting to see him play like an angry person, like we see John being in this. That would definitely also be interesting. Also, Baylor,
I enjoyed your description of the girl down the street's favorite person, but only if the girl down the street is 35 to 45.
Oh, jeez.
Brady, how about you finish off the beautiful casting segment?
Well, I also went the Twilight route, again, because I also don't know of hardly any Native American actors off the top of my head. I did not go with Taylor Lautner, though. I went with, instead, one of the other members of the Twilight Wolf Pack. I don't know what his name in the movie is, but the actor's name is Bronson Pelletier, or Pelletier, depending on how you pronounce the last name. And the reason I went with him is because John Manuelito seems like a very not nice person. And of all the wolves in the second Twilight movie, this guy plays the guy who's the meanest. He is Native American, and he'd have to grow his hair out, I think, at least from what he looks like in the Twilight movie. But he's my choice for John Manuelito because he looks angry.
Nice. I like
it. And just because I'm a quick Googler, he played Jared from the Twilight series.
There you go.
Lovely.
All you fans of Jared out there, hit me up.
Yeah. So that is our diversity cast of the week. Thank you, Inverarity, for writing in a Native American character for us.
It's true. You know, we grew up, all three of us grew up on the reservation, so we say we're ignorant of the culture, but we're definitely not ignorant of Native Americans as a people.
Yes, that is true.
So now that we've casted John Manuelito, let's move on to renaming the Ark. I'm going to go first this time, and it's because I feel like I probably have the worst name of us all. I called this arc Alexander Quick and the Brother Revealed. I just went straight back to Harry Potter-esque titles.
not to be a spoiler to my prediction, but is he her brother? To be determined. I'm just kidding.
I was going to say, doesn't it say it directly in the reading?
Listen, I know it's tough.
He could be Polyjuice.
Tell me I didn't spoil something insane.
I don't think so.
Oh, no. Yeah. No, I was just making a joke. No, you're good.
Okay. It does say that. Jeez.
I know it's tough to do this, especially on the fly and stuff like that. It's one of the worst titles I've ever heard in my entire life.
It's not great.
Because here's the other thing. This is for chapters 9 through 12. So you've essentially just spoiled a chapter that's four chapters later than where we're starting.
Yeah, it's fine.
Okay.
My title only has to do with literally the last four words of the whole reading. It's fine.
We spent an hour talking about dark magic in 4 seconds saying, oh, it's her brother. Well, I mean, hell, we spent more time talking about possible 18-year-old incest lovers than we spent on the brother reveal.
Listen, Delbert, I didn't pre-formulate my title like you did, okay?
True, because if you all remember, my title from last week for this, to fit with last week's of the dark arts, is the darker arts. And I feel like it continued to fit very well.
Oh, it's incredible.
Oh, great. Yeah. Now.
It's
almost as if you had read chapters 9 through 12 before this week.
Almost, crazy. Yes.
If the last arc was the dark arts, this one is definitely the darker arts.
Yeah.
Without question.
Yeah.
Baylor, what'd you name your arc?
So I struggled with this as well. But just because there was so much stuff. But I went ahead and went with Unforgivable Darkness with a cherry on top.
Wow.
Okay.
Still better than mine because it describes everything that happens, assuming the cherry on top is the twist we find out at the end with Max and Alex.
Dating.
Indeed. And the Unforgivable Curses making up the beginning of the title.
Okay. I like it. I do like it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's good.
It's good. You guys both did a good job.
Listen, I hate to say this. I agree.
Baylor, why don't you come hot off the press with your ARC MVP as well?
Sweet. So I actually, this wasn't mentioned in our discussion, but if it's okay with you guys, I would like to MVP two people. And you'll understand why in a second.
That makes it tougher for us, but you know what? You do whatever you want.
I doubt that you guys picked either of these people because, like I said, we didn't talk about them at all. But I went ahead and went with Stuart and Torvald. And the reason I wanted to is because they're basically Siamese twins that are attached. but I was proud of them. And this was really hard for me, too, because there just was so much stuff that happened. But I went with them because they showed themselves to not be typical bullies. And they actually quit the Mors Mortis Society as well, because they weren't about torturing animals and otherwise. So, good job, Stuart and Torvald.
Bravo. I like this pick a lot.
I do too.
I like it because it brings them up, which I meant to, and we never did.
Yeah.
And I think it's important that they also quit because they're like, whoa, this is way over the top.
Yeah.
I like that pick a lot.
Yeah.
Delbert, who do you pick?
Listen, I was scared. I had a pick that was so far out of left field that I thought there's no way that Baylor will steal it. No way Baylor's going to come in and say, I'd like to pick two people and you'll see why. But here we are with him not picking my MVPs of Constance and Forbearance.
Very nice.
Oh, very okay. Kind of a curveball, just like Stuart and Torvald. Not featured prominently. But them confronting Alex and turning away from her when they knew it was wrong, and that kind of leading her back away from the dark side of everything going on, was probably the most important thing for character development. And I like that. I like that they were like, listen, tell us what's happening. And when she refused, they said, okay, have a nice life. We're going to go hang out with ourselves.
Yeah, I really like this pick as well. I have to admit that I had considered them multiple times for MVP because of that reason exactly. That they're the ones, once again, driving Alex to actually try to be a better person.
Yep. Yeah. And surely, now that Baylor's picked a duo and I've picked a duo, you're going to pick the Rash twins, right?
I am not, but I am coming out of left field as well.
Oh, lovely.
My MVP for this arc is Honey the Jarvie.
Oh,
not because of anything Honey did, but because of what happened as a result of Honey existing. Horrible insults that I hate. I'm telling you, if Inverarity took those out of the book would be better, and it's already a really good book. But Honey the Jarvie getting kidnapped leads to Anna and Tomo finding common ground, and leads to Alex putting herself in a situation where Max, her brother, has to reveal himself as her brother to stop her from getting further in danger. And so, again, it's not by Honey's doing, but Honey's existence started the daisy chain of events.
Honey the Jarvie cleared Alex's wand of Avada Kedavra.
Oh, that's true. Honey the Jarvie, MVP.
Man.
Very nice.
Clutch of the book so far.
Yeah.
Very nice. With that being said, our arc MVP done, our renaming the arc done, our casting done. Baylor, you need to make a prediction, and we need to grade your prediction from last week. So would you please remind us what that was?
Okay, so I think Alex will go through the Mors Mortis Society initiation over Halloween, because that's what they've been talking about for a long time. From Brady's answer, we know that they will go into the forest and face their greatest fear, and I think Alex's biggest fear is losing a friend. And so I think the challenge will be similar to the second Goblet of Fire challenge, where they had to recover a friend, specifically for Alex, probably. And then I just think the middle two chapters, that I think she'll stay in the Mors Mortis Society. And I think the middle two chapters are just a buildup of the challenges, because they said, you know, initiation isn't everything. There'll be more to it after. And so I think it'll be a build up there, and then the finale will be they have to cast Crucio on a close friend.
All right. Interesting.
Just so you know, you can't give me a zero. Wait, you can give me a one.
I don't think this is leading to a zero at all. In fact, I think it's pretty good.
The other way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's pretty good. Okay. I will say that you're incorrect on in the middle.
On her staying
in the Mors Mortis Society.
Yeah.
But everything else kind of lands.
Yeah. I mean, her biggest fear was losing a friend, and that is the original form that the Boggart takes.
Correct.
Yeah.
Dead friends. And then the dark arts part of the Mors Mortis Society escalated to casting Crucio.
Yeah.
Not on a friend, but still to casting Crucio. So to call out the exact spell, that's pretty good.
I don't know. She takes the snake home. It's kind of a friend.
Yeah. So,
loosely.
To be honest, for me, this prediction is a strong 7.
I was even leaning 8.
Well, luckily we're doing individual grades this time.
True.
So for me, it's a 7.
I'll stick with my 8.
All right.
Wow.
Best prediction went, so far.
Absolutely. That went way better than I thought. I thought I was nearing a 1 or a 2. I'm not going to lie.
Oh, gosh. It was way better than that.
Yeah. I mean, you hit on 2 of the points really well.
Really well.
Yeah.
I will say I feel like that student who got a problem wrong, but the teacher graded it correctly because one of the chapters was titled Crucio. But the final grade has been submitted. It's been saved. So it's over, just so you know.
Now we need you to make a prediction for our next story arc, which is going to cover one chapter. Chapter 13, titled Maximilian's Mission.
Oh, boy. You think my prediction will be better? Do you have some questions for us? I don't know. I do. Let's see. Let's start with Delbert this time. I think I've been starting with Brittany a lot. Delbert,
lovely.
Would Alex be happy to help Max succeed at his plan?
Alex would be happy to do anything that's not approved by Dean Grimm.
That is the most typical Delbert answer I've ever heard. Okay. Birdie, this is kind of going down a little bit darker road, I would say, but is Maximilian relevant in the series after this book?
He's mentioned.
He's mentioned. Okay.
That's vague. I like it.
Yeah. Just a little vague, you know, but it
might be a hindrance to nothing.
He just got a 7.5, and I much prefer the predictions when they're like a 2 or 3.
Right.
Well, I'm sure that this one will be bizarre. So I guess here goes nothing. I think Maximilian has been given a plan from Abraham Thorne. He is to be his inside man and will try to get to Governor General Huckstein to become a double agent for Thorne. Simultaneously, Max has been sent to keep an eye on Alex and keep her out of trouble. Furthermore, I think Max, after being invited to the Mors Mortis Society meetings, was instructed to figure out how to use the lands below for Thorne's benefit. I believe Max has direct contact with Thorne, and this will allow him, being Thorne, to talk to Alex in real time for the first time. Finally, I think the person we see in Alex's vision from a couple chapters ago went over the brazier that disappears into the lands below is Max, and he ends up dying.
Okay. I don't know that that's all going to get resolved in one chapter.
Isn't this a prediction for the next chapter?
However, one hell of a prediction. I'm excited to see how correct you are.
Huh.
I think that's it. I think we've done it for another week.
Could you imagine book one format on here? This section taking 4 weeks with 3 pretty big cliffhangers?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It would be kind of fun. But I also like talking about all of it at once.
Yeah,
like
Baylor would be suffering.
And the great news is that we have to wait 4 weeks to record now anyways because I'm going on vacation for a month.
True. If you want to meet up with Brady, He'll be in Sydney, Australia for 3 weeks.
That's true. I'll be at the Sydney Opera House at 8 a.m. on June 29th.
Which 8 a.m.? You have to find out.
Good luck finding it.
I heard he actually got invited to North Korea, but man, I must be lost.
North Korea?
I have already been. Can't recommend.
Huh.
Can't recommend at all. Not much better than Iran.
I think I'd rather go to North Korea than Burkina Faso.
Cool. So with all those fun countries thrown out, I think we should end this thing.
Yeah.
We'll see you guys next Sunday. I've been Brady.
I've been Delbert.
I've been Baylor.
Good night.